Cemetery News Now.
Welcome to another episode of Telemetry News Now. We are recording today on Wednesday, August 6, 2025. I almost said 2005, my goodness. And we do have a bunch of headlines for you today, but I do want to start with some significant news from the Gervasi house. Justin, I don't know what the basement situation is in your home where you live outside St. Louis, but here in upstate New York, I do have a below grade basement, and it's very humid in the Northeast in the summer. So I do run a dehumidifier pretty much all summer. It's a dry basement, but I do run one. And I've always had the task to manually remove and empty the water container, the bucket, every day. And the only reason I didn't attach a hose is because I'm lazy. And finally, I made a trip to Home Depot, picked up an appropriate length hose, and then ran a hose from the dehumidifier to the corner of the basement where I have the sump pump. And I'll tell you, it's the little things, because that is a game changer in my life that I don't have to think about it. And it just runs permanently until the motor gives out.
I think that's what they call automation, Phil. Automated that task that was manual and cumbersome. So, yeah, no, thankfully I don't have to do that in the house that I'm in now, but I have lived in houses in Missouri where dehumidifier was a fact of life. So being able to have it drain out automatically and not have to remove and empty that bucket every time it fills up, I can understand why that's a laborious task.
Yeah, yeah. And I have an older house where I don't have a humidifier or dehumidifier built into my air conditioning and heating system.
Yeah,
I do have baseboard radiant heat and then a central air separate. So I know some newer houses have that, but not me. But thank you for bringing it back and bringing it home and somehow finding a way to tie that to networking. Very good. So let's get into the headlines today. We're going to start with some big news from Intel. Now, you may have heard of some of the layoffs happening, but from CRN and other sources last week, Intel plans to spin off its Network and Edge group, also known as NEX or NEX, into a standalone company, also seek outside investors, not sure what that's going to look like yet, and keep a meaningful anchor, quote-unquote anchor stake, which pretty much mirrors the Altera playbook from earlier this year. So this new spun-off unit is going to focus on silicon for communications, enterprise networking, and Ethernet connectivity. So we're talking about actual network cards. And I haven't seen anything yet about timing. And so I'm pretty sure that the timing wasn't disclosed yet. Justin, I don't know if you kind of looked around and saw anything, but so far haven't seen anything about that. Now, this move lands alongside a broader restructuring under the new CEO, Lip-Bu Tan, which, as many people are painfully aware, included substantial workforce cuts, thousands and thousands of people laid off recently from Intel. And that's, you know, ultimately to narrow Intel's focus on core CPU, foundry adjacent AI silicon, that's the thing lately, and also monetizing non-core assets. So, you know, I think if this spinoff works as intended, as an independent organization, NEX could move quicker, obviously, on roadmaps. Right now, they're working on the E830 Ethernet family of network adapters, so that's something. And that's a space where a lot of folks believe that Intel actually trails NVIDIA and Broadcom in high-end throughput, high-end offload. So that could be a net gain for that initiative. And I think if this carve-out accelerates Ethernet innovation, right? I mean, that's good news for network operators, especially if you're betting on Ethernet-based AI fabrics, which you should be. But, you know, and I think, you know business, Justin, until funding, leadership, and then there's like a concrete roadmap are public, I'd still treat this as like a watch and verify situation. So in other words, you know, lock in your supply commitments and kind of keep a plan B for your NIC vendor and your bills of materials.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, the timing isn't fully disclosed. The articles that I was reading did say that they still haven't finalized the sale of Altera to Silver Lake. That's supposed to happen in September. So presumably they're going to have to bring in, a lot of times what you'll do is you'll get a contract with an investment banker, right, that will come in, especially if they're going to like make this a publicly traded company that they just hold a percentage of the shares in. They'll need to come in and get an investment banker. They'll come in, do due diligence, figure out what the asset is worth, figure out how to price the shares, help them do the offering and the listing. So there's a lot of, you know, finance type of work that has to be done before they can, you know, list it. If that's what they're going to do, it really isn't clear whether they're going to publicly list it or they're going to try and find like private equity like they did with Altera, where they're bringing someone like Silver Lake to buy the other parts of it. So it's unclear yet who the, whether it'll be publicly listed or be a private sale, but yeah, definitely will be interesting to see where this goes. And presumably this helps get some cash back into Intel parent company, right? Which helps them accelerate their roadmap, because as we know, they've fallen behind when it comes to some of the GPUs and stuff with NVIDIA,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So presumably selling off some of these assets, which still have some value, right? Allows them to get some cash that they can infuse back into the business and build faster roadmaps, try and catch up with NVIDIA on some of the GPU stuff.
Yep. I did see a couple of mentions of the possibility of PE firms involved. And, you know, it's not, I think, outside the realm of possibility for even Intel to be one of the owners, Intel proper, right? And not as a subsidiary, right? Not as, but just as another investor and owner. So they have some stake still retaining. And, you know, I agree with you about the networking component and this ability to be more nimble and agile, not necessarily nimble and agile, but be able to innovate more quickly and focused. So this particular organization, the whole networking organization, can be focused in a way that it might not necessarily be able to right now. And, I foresee the possibility of some partnerships with OEMs and cloud vendors that we haven't seen before, or at least strengthening and making that a little more of an aggressive initiative. So I think there's some good opportunity here. I wasn't expecting that. And certainly, on the heels of the workforce reduction, that was very significant and top of mind for a lot of folks.
Well, you had to think that, I mean, they didn't bring in a new CEO to keep things status quo, right? So you had to know some things were coming. True, I agree with you. I didn't see this necessarily coming. Unfortunately, the layoffs have been announced. We knew that was coming. And I'm sure there will be, more changes coming, right? I don't know what they look like, but they brought in a new CEO to kind of right the tide here with Intel. So I expect we'll see more changes as the longer he's on the job. So. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So from Network World on August 5, Cisco's Foundation AI team is partnering with Hugging Face to scan every public file uploaded to the platform. That's models and other AI-related artifacts with an upgraded Clam AV engine that flags AI-specific threats. So think about things like deserialization risks, like in specific files, threats like that, and also do that in milliseconds. So Clam AV's detections that would allow, or rather it would also show up in virus total and also builds on prior joint efforts like Cerberus. The idea here is that it's feeding standardized AI supply chain threat intel, and it's going right into Cisco security products. So the integrations then are going to span things like secure endpoints, secure email, secure access. And the idea is that you have this ability for policy enforcement, like blocking risky AI models, maybe non-approved sources of those models, compliance checks for like licensing and things like that. From the article, Cisco says that they're positioning this as, quote, democratizing AI model anti-malware, unquote, and then also scales protection across Hugging Face. Because remember, Hugging Face is currently hosting almost 2 million models mm-hmm. and all sorts of derivatives. Not only that, but it's a forum and a community. It's very, very valuable in a lot of ways. But as far as models, it's almost 2 million. And Justin, I remember doing a Telemetry News Now episode with you not that long ago where the number was like 1 million. It's just crazy. Now, to be fair, of those 2 million models, many are variations of the same model. It's not 2 million distinct foundation models. It's not like that. But certainly there's still a lot going on. And I mean, security issues, specifically around operationalizing AI, actually deploying AI into your production environment, that's become top of mind for a lot of IT leaders. Yeah. So I think this is a big move for Cisco. And I also really think it's interesting that they're partnering with Hugging Face, kind of like an open AI, not open AI, the company, but like open artificial intelligence repository and forum and community. I mean, we could get into the security aspects around foundation models like GPT and Claude. That's kind of a different thing. But so many people are using models that they get from Hugging Face right now, not just in their labs and POC like me, but in production as well. So I do like how this pretty much allows network security people to like sleep at night. You can treat models like artifacts, like any other kind of risky payload. You set up your policies, allow lists, compliance checks, whatever you're doing, right? Reputation checks for all those model downloads moving over your corporate network. It's really addressing that major growing concern among a lot of IT folks, like security concern.
Yeah, I mean, to your point about how quickly Hugging Face is growing, in the Network World article, it said Hugging Face adds a new model on average every 7 seconds. So, I mean, it's like kind of the YouTube of AI models, right? I mean, they're just exploding right now as far as the amount that are being developed and hosted up there. And you have to imagine, not all of those 2 million models that are out there are malware free, right? Somewhere, somebody, some bad actor has put malware into one of these models or is training the data on bad data. I mean, there's all kinds of attack vectors that, you know, open source could potentially bring when you talk about open model development. And so the idea here, that from what I understand, is that Cisco is able, if you've got like Cisco firewalls in your environment, is able to actually do some inspection of the traffic that's flowing through the firewall, detect that there's malware, and then even do the enforcement to block that traffic. So it's, you know, not at the network layer, it's actually at the application layer, but the AI model and the transmission of the data as the workload that it's actually inspecting, which is, you know, pretty cool. I mean, we've had application firewalls for a while for other applications, but specifically for AI models and AI workloads, kind of an interesting spin on it.
Yep. And I would say a necessary spin for sure.
Oh, yeah, so for sure.
Cisco's getting ahead of this and partnering with an organization like Hugging Face, I think, is a big deal. So also from Network World on August 5, a report from ISG finds SD-WAN is now mainstream. That's not news. That's not the news part.
Welcome to 2021.
It's just very common. Yeah, right. And, you know, the report finds that it's very common in large enterprises and growing among SMBs. Not news. You know, I saw that, but I saw that happening before my eyes years ago when I left the VAR space. That was only a few years ago, actually. And I remember whenever I spoke with customers, and I was networking focused as far as my specialty. Whenever I spoke to customers about a router refresh or some sort of a WAN project, and typically very large customers, usually it was an SD-WAN conversation. There were exceptions, of course, but what's interesting here in this report is that most organizations are overlaying SD-WAN on existing networks rather than doing a full rip and replace. And so the idea of a fully autonomous WAN with extensive policy, multiple links, all that stuff, is by and large, according to the report, largely still aspirational for a lot of organizations and still requires engineers to very actively manage. I got a lot of opinions here, but I'm going to keep going. So again, from the report, SASE adoption, which does vary by like region, by industry, you know, the size of your organization, and also Edge plus Private G is helping to move this along from an aspirational thing to reality. And then looking ahead, ISG expects deeper integration across new transports. So think of like satellite, like Starlink and Kuiper, and also, you know, new Wi-Fi standards coming out.
Mm, interesting.
You know, yeah, I don't, the initial part of this report, I don't think there's anything groundbreaking here, because most of the customers that I worked with, large customers we're talking about, unless it was pure greenfield or some kind of interesting exception, they were never really able to do a huge WAN rip and replace from traditional routers in a brownfield environment to a complete pure SD-WAN, you know, as a project, as a cutover on Friday night. I mean, typically, yeah, if you're thinking about a large organization with many, many sites and various types of sites, including data centers and all this kind of thing, you ended up with a 3-year project to slowly migrate.
Or more.
And most of that time you had a hybrid network. You had many sites where you were just getting the boxes into place and operating over what you had until you could get circuits moved, because, you know, you have to put in an order for a new 100 gig circuit at your data center. And that took 6 months to get put, you know, all of those factors involved there. So, yeah, I do believe that it depends on the industry and the size of your organization, that sort of thing. But I also think that a lot of it is, you know, the culture. How much is your security team, your network managers, that kind of thing? How much are they willing to allow SD-WAN policy purely to manage your WAN as opposed to maybe a light touch management? And the answer is, you know, not many. I mean, most folks are going to want some kind of operational light touch management, even over a fully autonomous WAN. And when I say fully autonomous, I say that almost like tongue in cheek, because it's never fully autonomous. You're still actively managing those policies and making adjustments as your network changes and stuff. But yeah, I wanted to bring this article into it because, you know, we're still talking about SD-WAN, and I just sort of had an interesting, not that I'm calling my own takes interesting, but I had my own pointed opinion about what ISG found in their report.
Yeah, I mean, we worked at Kintiq with a partnership with an SD-WAN vendor. This is going back, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. They actually approached us and wanted to partner with us. And at the time, I thought, you know, that's kind of strange, because all these SD-WAN vendors have their own observability of the traffic that flows through their SD-WAN, right? That as you as an end user can log in and see all of your traffic and where it's flowing and all that kind of stuff. So I thought it was interesting that they would approach us and want to partner on network observability. the more we started talking to them, what they were saying was exactly this, Phil, right? The majority of their customers that are of any scale or size at all have a migration plan over 3 years. In fact, the one beta customer that we worked on this partnership with was a five-year plan, five-year rollout, right? Because they have thousands of sites around the globe, right? And not all of those are, like you were saying, within the reach of a nice 1 gig fiber connection. Some of them are like, have to be connected by satellite, or the best they can get is DSL connectivity, you know, these days or whatever. So, yeah. You know, connectivity is a challenge. Getting the boxes out there installed, cut over, all of that is a challenge, and it takes time and it takes a whole migration plan. So like you said, most of these enterprises wind up in a hybrid WAN. I don't know if that's a Gartner approved term or not, but you know, a hybrid WAN where some of the sites are on their historical WAN. It was presumably like some sort of MPLS service that they were running or that they were buying from a provider over to internet circuits with, you know, SD-WAN appliances and an SD-WAN solution running on top of it. That migration takes multiple years for a large organization. So that part of it, at the time, all the SD-WAN vendors had marketing that would make you think, oh yeah, yesterday you had your old WAN and tomorrow you'll have SD-WAN and you'll do the cutover over a weekend and you'll be good to go or whatever. Well, reality that enterprises are seeing is it's just like migrating to the cloud, right? For most organizations, unless you're a really small organization, it's not happening overnight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there are some things that we can say with regard to cloud connectivity. There are absolute major significant benefits that happen when you migrate to an SD-WAN, even in a hybrid situation. You do gain that single portal to manage many of your sites. You do have the ability to connect to cloud, over whatever VPN connectivity you use much more easily. There's policy involved. So there's a lot of benefit, but there are just so many permutations and aspects to migrating all of your stuff that, I mean, just think about, when your next change window is. Imagine a change window for your active data center. And let's say your data centers are really big because you're a big company, right? Or a huge national bank. You're not changing, you're not just going to buy those boxes, stick them in the rack, and then your change window is this Friday. It's probably like months from now and series of cab meetings and all these things and rollback procedures and all that stuff.
Testing it out.
Yeah. All that stuff. Yeah, yep. All of it. And so the reality is that these are very long-term strategies. And so, again, that's why this report kind of struck me, because I was like, of course it's aspirational for a lot of folks because we're not there yet. You know, if you're starting your SD-WAN strategy just now, it's going to be a few years before you get there. Again, unless you're greenfield or you have some exception or you can stay... You know, I have done projects where I stood up parallel networks. We were able to do that. Like all the circuits were net new and we were to set up a parallel network. And then we cut things over by literally moving wires or just changing a route or whatever we had to do, suppress a route and advertise different prefixes, whatever we did with an easy rollback. And so you can cut certain things over like in a night, but it did take us many, many months to get there, of course, in order to stage that entire parallel network and get all of the policies perfect. So that way, you know, your latency requirements were being met, your SLAs were being met, your security things were being met, your even things like certificate management among all your boxes. And I remember back when it was a matter of folks coming to me and saying, oh, but I thought I could just upgrade like my ISR to the SD-WAN image. And I'm like, we're going to have to like reboot all your routers, install, you know, obviously you install the new image, reboot your router, do the whole spiel. And then there's going to be a rollback plan. So, I mean, even that was like, I was always really nervous. I'm like, can we just buy new stuff, please?
Yeah.
So there's a lot there.
Procedure on that's really messy if that goes wrong.
It is. And I've been there, unfortunately. But I do think, again, going back to cloud, SASE, things like that, you know, that does make sense. And I believe that the ISG report does call that out correctly, that is going to be a major motivator and it is a major benefit as well. So, we're still seeing growth and changes and even just pure adoption for the very first time of SD-WAN, in spite of it being a very mature technology right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other interesting thing in the article was they were talking about how AI copilots on top of these SD-WAN solutions come into play. And they actually made the point that they don't see evidence of completely autonomous WAN tuning using a Gen AI copilot, right? What they really see happening is more of a supervised learning where there's a human still in the loop. The AI can make some suggestions on rerouting of traffic, presumably collecting all the telemetry and saying, hey, you've got an application performance issue because this application is taking the wrong path on your WAN, and can provide some suggested remediations to some of those things. But you know, their research was showing that customers are not quite to the point where they're doing this completely autonomous and it's just completely self-driving, if you will. So, which kind of meets with the, what I hear from talking to customers, and I assume it's probably the same for you, Phil.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
The next article is from Network World titled Broadcom ships new Jericho 4 Ethernet fabric router. Broadcom is adding to their list of chips the Jericho 4 chip, which joins their Tomahawk Ultra and Tomahawk 6, which are chips that they sell to people who are building network switches, Ethernet switches, for mostly for HPC and distributed AI environments, right? So where people are building AI GPU clusters, distributed clusters, that's primarily where these Jericho 4 chips are being sold into that they're announcing. Interestingly, that they were saying that the new Jericho 4 has a lot higher buffers than a lot of the previous generations, which allows for it to do what they call high bandwidth memory packet buffering, HBM packet buffering, which supports low power usage, but also being able to have 160 times more buffering on the chip than they've had in previous versions. And the idea behind this is being able to do a distributed Ethernet fabrics for AI workload trainings across multiple data centers. So if you've got, let's say, three data centers in a geographic region, instead of them all being in the same row and in the same rack inside the same physical building, they might be across a campus or something. Once you go that amount of distance, you're going to need to have some amount of buffering based on, you know, whether the packets are ready to go out the egress interface and so forth. So having these deeper buffers allows for that. And of course, this would be Rocky V2 environments. The interface speeds here are interesting, Phil. They should be able to go up. Well, they will be able to go up to 3.2 terabits per second. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the Ethernet interfaces and optics and all that stuff are ready to go for 3.2 terabit ports, but that's what the chip is now capable of, right? So it future proofs it a little bit for the people who are putting these switches into their environments to be able to do 3.2 terabit links up to 36,000 what they call hyper ports, which are these 3.2 terabit ports. So just amazing the speeds and feeds that these environments are demanding in order to build these huge distributed clusters that some of the hyperscalers are building.
I love the term hyperports. So applicable.
You know, I'm still kind of skeptical on this building a fabric across multiple data centers, because one of the things we know about these AI environments is they're very latency sensitive, right? Any amount of latency can really impact your job completion time when you're running these jobs. And so I don't know, I guess I'm just still a little skeptical that companies are really going to build clusters that distribute across multiple data centers. To me, this just seems like the idea of doing a vMotion from data center to data center.
Sure. Right?
Like,
oh, yeah.
Yes, it can be done. Is it a good idea? Probably not from a design and engineering perspective.
Okay. All right. I know where you're coming from, and I agree with you, especially if we're considering traditional networking, but we're talking about zero packet loss under heavy congestion, 3.2 terabit ports, line rate MACSEC, the ability to go, I forgot how long, you said many kilometers, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I assume with, you know, all of the boxes ticked for latency and for packet loss and all that kind of stuff, insofar as it relates to the networking, not like to the GPUs themselves and that kind of thing. You know, the thing is that we're still in this world of brute force AI, where we throw more resources, bigger physical data center, more of a footprint with the, you know, the more racks, the more GPUs and that sort of thing. And yes, I know we talked about small models and decreasing the size of models and making them industry specific or task specific in order to solve some of this. But generally speaking, the underlying method here is still brute force, more horsepower, more resources. And so you can't, I mean, feasibly build a data center that's under one roof, the size of an entire town or something like that. So they're going to be distributed. And that's kind of what's happening now. Now, until we move away from that brute force method and we have more smaller models that are on par with foundation models and that sort of thing, I actually think that this is this whole like long haul interconnect for GPU connectivity is kind of a necessity now. I mean, I get it. It's like it opens up the door to more issues for latency and things like that. And you mentioned job completion time, but that's what this fabric router is addressing those kinds of things.
Yeah.
It's going to be eye-wateringly expensive, of course. And
sure.
But what's the alternative? It is to focus on those small models and doing something completely different. I just don't see that really happening. A lot of folks are still focusing on brute force.
I mean, when you say a lot of folks, I mean, I guess we're talking about the hyperscalers here, like Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, right? Like,
yeah,
I don't
the
see
the clouds, the hyperscalers, yeah. You know, yeah, the big right. AI companies for right. Sure. You're right.
I guess maybe this just seems like one of those things that maybe those three companies, maybe a couple more, you know, would do or would need, because they're just, like you said, brute force, just building the biggest clusters, you know, tens, twenties, thirties, thousands of GPUs in a single cluster, right? Just brute forcing it. I just think, you know, you roll down to like the enterprise Fortune 100 companies, once they start doing, you know, their own AI, and so a lot of them already are building their own AI fabrics. I just don't see them being at that scale. I could see them wanting to be more efficient, trying to figure out more efficient models to be able to fit within the footprint of a single data sure. center versus yeah. saying, all right, let's just brute force it,
yeah.
and throw billions of dollars at this problem and buy Jericho 4 chips and build it across three data centers in a metro region. So this just seems like one of those techs that, that part of it, at least, is not going to trickle down outside of the hyperscalers for some time.
No, but who cares? I mean, it's purpose built for that customer. Sure. You know, whatever. I mean, just like I'm not buying a Ferrari, but there are people that do, and they're a very, very, very tiny, small subset of the population, and they're going to buy them. So there is a market for it, and so you know that's what this is. And maybe we move away from this brute force method where we have not just big data centers, but distributed multiple data centers across a geographic area, all doing the same training run. And then that stops, and this router becomes irrelevant. Sure. And then Broadcom puts something else out there. But for now, that's where we're going. And so that's where I think the significance for this particular router, this Jericho 4 Ethernet fabric router, plays in for sure.
All right. Moving on. The next article is from Palo Alto's newsroom. Palo Alto Networks buys CyberArk. CyberArk is the identity security leader, so they're able to do identity management and identity security for a lot of different types of workloads, human workloads, machine workloads, AI workloads. So Palo Alto has acquired them for what would be the equivalent of about $25 billion. The term of the agreement is that each shareholder will receive $45 in cash per share that they hold, as well as 2.2005 shares of Palo Alto's stock themselves. So if you're a CyberArk shareholder and you hold on to it through the acquisition, you'll receive some amount of cash and some amount of Palo Alto shares for each share of CyberArk that you hold. That represents a 26% premium over the 10-day average of what CyberArk's stock was trading for as of Friday, July 5th. So I guess a couple weeks ago as we're recording this. The interesting thing here is I had not heard of CyberArk, Bill. I don't know if you had,
no. But
they're, I guess, a pretty large company in this space doing identity security and privileged access management, PAM. You know, Palo obviously wants to roll this into their broader security portfolio, you know, for doing a lot of, like, again, identity management and privileged access, allowing people to figure out whether this AI workload, for example, should be allowed to pass traffic on the network, be able to allow for access based on, you know, what the workload is, things like that. I'm not a security expert, so I don't get all the bits and pieces of it, but that's my understanding of the value here to customers, being able to integrate this identity management into Palo Alto's broader security portfolio for their things like their firewall and their WAN and some of those kind of capabilities.
Yep. And networking itself, which, you know, our agentic AI workflows are going to operate on top of, calling various tools and interfacing with the LLM brain and whatever agent system, it runs on the network. And so we need to focus less on IP-centric controls and more on identity-centric enforcement. I mean, everything flows through APIs now, right? And whatever CI/CD pipeline. So you need those just-in-time credentials and credential authorization, you know, AAA, all that kind of stuff, session control, all of that stuff.
Yep.
Especially for like our field, if you're using that kind of thing to then also manage your network and your network operations or IT operations more broadly. So there's certainly that component, not just agents, but everything that we do now that does flow through APIs. And the concept of the shared telemetry, because you remember you're talking about a huge amount of telemetry that you're going to gather as far as access control and all of that and user information, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of information there as well. So you're going to get kind of more of a consolidation or maybe a simplification of telemetry. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a little bit of lock-in right there because you're just consolidating it into one platform that Palo Alto has, whether you care about that or not, whatever.
Well, one person calls vendor lock-in, another one calls well-integrated solutions, vertically integrated solutions, right? Yeah. So it's,
yeah. Absolutely.
Six of one, half dozen. I guess it depends on what you're trying to accomplish,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And it does, you know, it makes it easier, especially if you're a brownfield network, to consolidate, you know, network controls and that kind of thing. And if you have like a zero trust policy that you're developing, you don't have to like forklift upgrade everything. You can sort of integrate these into your current Palo solution.
All right, moving on. The next article is from Cisco's newsroom. Cisco keeps taking steps towards quantum networking. So, Phil, we've talked a couple times on the news podcast about quantum computing and specifically quantum networking. I think, as I said before, I'm really interested. I'm really excited to see where quantum networking can take us. Been doing networking for 25 years. Latency over a given distance was always just sort of an accepted normal because of the laws of physics, right? Speed of light and some of those kind of things. You just assume if I'm going to transmit data from the west coast of the United States to the east coast of the United States, there's, call it 25 millisecond round trip latency. You're going to have to deal with it. There's just nothing you can do about that because that's the speed of light through glass, and that's just, you know, the way it is. Quantum networking in theory brings us the ability to transmit data over that distance with zero latency, right? So Cisco's continuing to do more research. They have an entire Cisco Labs, quantum labs, that's started really applying the quantum, as the article talks about, more to the computing side of things, right? And being able to do things like medical research, drug interaction research, some of those kind of things much faster and like a high-performance computing using quantum computing. But as part of their research, they're also looking at like how can this technology be applied to networking, right? To large WAN networks and so forth. So, you know, the article doesn't have a lot of details on new stuff that they've come out with, but it does have some interesting tidbits from Ramana Kampela, who's the head of Cisco Research and a distinguished Cisco fellow, talking about the steps they've taken transferring quantum information to these entanglements. So the idea of entanglement is that there's two photons, and if you change the state of one and observe the other one, you can basically know the state of either one. And that's the idea here, is if you can apply that to networking, you can actually kind of, if you think of like we do binary transmission of data, right? You can actually figure out whether it should be a zero or a one based on observing the state of it, is at least my limited understanding of quantum things.
Yeah, I think it's really, there's really nothing especially new in this particular article, but it's Cisco bringing it up again. So it's just really interesting to me to see that they're continuing to go down this road and they're building an ecosystem, but they're not just doing that internally. They are working with universities, I think you mentioned, standard bodies. They want to ensure interoperability, how to scale this, how to do responsible deployment. And again, the idea being like you're not deploying this monolithic quantum computer, but, you know, laying this groundwork for practical quantum networks. And I love reading the word teleportation in these articles. Again, nothing necessarily new in this headline, other than to say that they're still working on it and they're still expanding this research and connecting with folks in industry. And this is something to keep an eye on, as we have, but certainly something to keep an eye on. And I believe that even if nothing comes of it and it doesn't go anywhere and it dies on the vine, it's certainly important news to keep an eye on how the networking industry is looking at advancing and solving some of the problems that we have today. Mm-hmm. Whether it's this or it becomes a different solution, we don't know.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Most of the article talks about quantum networking for the purpose of doing distributed quantum computing.
Yeah,
right?
Okay, true.
Which is one interesting application, and that's clearly what Cisco's doing the majority of this research for. But to me, the more interesting application, just because that's one more of my interest lies, is being able to apply it to like AI workloads, right? Like going back to that article we were talking about with the Jericho 4 chip, if you had theoretically a quantum network and you could do Jericho chips, and now you can do data centers that are distributed with zero latency, it does make being able to build these huge brute-forced distributed AI clusters across data centers even outside of the metro area. You know, maybe you could even distribute them across the country if you could do zero latency. Again, this is all still future stuff, but that to me is where this is really interesting, is like not just for quantum computing, but the existing applications that we have on the network. You know, what's the potential impact in how we build and design networks if we don't have to design for latency, and the impact that latency has on how we build and design the networks opens up a whole different realm of ways that you could distribute this out. I mean, you could potentially buy land in the cheapest and coolest place you can buy it and distribute the data from Northern Virginia to someplace in North Dakota where power, space, and cooling are really cheap. I mean, there's all kinds of really interesting ideas that this could bring up.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert in quantum mechanics and quantum computing or anything like that, but if I understand correctly, it's zero latency anywhere in the universe. That's how quantum entanglement works. So it's not like across the country. It's like another planet. You'd still have the same effect because of the way that particles are entangled. Spooky, but whatever it's called. I don't remember. Anyway, I don't know where this is going, but certainly it's some interesting technology that
really interesting.
I really don't
for
understand
like
it enough.
Satellite internet, right? High Earth orbit. So you have the reach of high Earth orbit without the latency constraints that would normally bring. I hadn't even thought about that. That'd be really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So moving on to upcoming events, and we're just going to cover the next, let's say the next 2 months here. We have the Michigan Networking User Group, a part of the USNUA in Detroit on August 13. We have the New York Networking User Group in Buffalo, August 21. And then we have the very first, this is the inaugural California Networking User Group in San Francisco on August 21. I'll be attending that, and I'll be speaking about some practical uses and implementations of AI, specifically in network operations. That's what I'll be speaking about. If you're in that area, you can register at the USNUA's website and just go to the events page or scroll all the way to the bottom. You'll see it. Then we have the Ohio Networking User Group in Cincinnati on September 4th. Justin, I believe you're going to be there speaking.
Yep, I'm doing the keynote for that one on content that broke the internet. So one of the things I find kind of a nerdy passion of mine is being able to combine current events and media things that are going on and what we actually can see about it on the internet now that all this content is, of course, distributed out to users over the internet. So,
yep. Great. We also have YADA Las Vegas, September 8 through 10. Kentuck will be there, and I believe Steve Muse will be speaking on behalf of Kentuck. So that'll be good. And then we have DCD London, September 16 through 17, which is data center dynamics. A lot of stuff about, you know, AI workloads in the data center, but also in data center infrastructure and compute and all of that other stuff. So lots of great events coming up. We will start seeing that list expand, especially as we get into the fall and the conference season really picks up some steam. So for now, thanks so much for listening. Those are the headlines.